The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
The last couple of years have been an incredibly exciting and important time for the Balkan Peninsula. So most people somewhat familiar with the situation in Greece, dozens of general strikes, massive anti-fascist mobilizations, and most importantly, the rise of Syriza to state power. And of course, in the last week, things have come to a head between a standoff between the government of the left and the European Union. But while the austerity in Greece, which helped drive the process of radicalization in Greek society, has been particularly acute, austerity in southeastern Europe, and the Balkans in particular, has been widespread. This is the outcome of a historical process which has left the region, despite its strategic and importance and rich resources, quite poor on the whole, leaving the Balkan working classes particularly vulnerable to the worst ravages of the crisis. So, yet it is in precisely this context we've actually seen a remarkable political shift and reemergence of struggle. Just to give you a sense of a few of the struggles since 2011, which is really when we see one of the last sets of explosions in Greece, obviously there were more back in 2008. In addition to that, we've seen Serbian youth occupy cinemas as a protest against austerity and demand that art be for the people. Demonstrations in Kosovo have continued against continued Western intervention and occupation, and particularly the privatization schemes aimed at public services and the country's natural resources. In Macedonia, just weeks before the rebellion in Ferguson occurred, thousands of Albanian youth took to the streets during a trial in which Albanians were given life sentences for terrorism on rather flimsy evidence, even as known war criminals walked free. And they marched through the streets chanting something which I think will be quite familiar to people who are familiar with the sort of rhetoric in this country as well. The banner said, "We are not terrorists, we just want justice." In Croatia, thousands took to the streets after the Social Democratic government unilaterally canceled collective bargaining agreements in healthcare, education, research, and cultural sectors. Protests against austerity and corruption in Hungary, with protesters standing up to the regime of Viktor Orban, and in Bucharest, Romania, where protesters clashed with police several times earlier this year against the new austerity regime. Slovenia, which is, first, actually, can I just do quickly a, who here is like, knows where the countries are in the Balkans? Like, okay, I don't want to talk over people, but like, I also was like, I realize people don't know a lot about this area of the world, and if you don't know where something is, it's okay. I'm not, anyway. But anyway, so Slovenia has been a real focus of Europe's ideologues, and just generally the ideologues of the West, like Bloomberg News, which declared it the austerity success story for the government's willingness to roll over the rights of citizens and destroy the public sector. Montenegro, where protesters called demonstrations not only against the policies of their own government, but in solidarity with the people of Bosnia, whose revolt was one of the best organized and most politically coherent outside of Greece. Bosnia has taken to the streets, the organizers in Montenegro declared. Tens of thousands of unemployed, hungry, and robbed people should take justice into their own hands. And as I just alluded to, in what's perhaps the most significant revolt outside of Greece, the anti-austerity movement in Bosnia, led by Bosnian workers, actually established a short but effective control of the northern industrial city of Tuzla in 2014. Government buildings were burned, and graffiti sprung up around the city that read "Death to Nationalism." The workers established a plenum, which is a body much like the Soviets of the Russian Revolution, and issued a statement which explained, quote, "Accumulated anger and rage are the causes of aggressive behavior. The attitude of the authorities has created the conditions for anger and rage to escalate. Now, in this situation, we wish to direct the anger and rage into the building of a productive and useful system of government." And again, the northern industrial section of Bosnia was under workers' control for at least a few weeks, and I don't think that outside of Socialist Worker and one or two other outlets that was really even reported in the Western media. So none of this is to suggest that it's all onward and upward socialist revolution in the Balkans, or that this isn't a political landscape that is fraught with problems, contradictions and outright dangers, and that's particularly the resurgent far right, which is most notable in the expression of Golden Dawn, but which has its echoes around the peninsula in different forms. But it's certainly a very, the examples I just laid out are a very different perspective than you'll see usually in the Western media, where the people of the Balkan Peninsula are simultaneously portrayed as incorrigibly backwards and patriarchal barbarians, bound up by ancient blood feuds and ethnic tensions, and then in the next sentence as victims in need of Western salvation, impoverished people on the brink of civilization desperate to join the European Union. Which is a very bizarre thing to hear people being described as the edge of Europe when they are literally affixed to the European continent. So, to give you a sense of the sort of rhetoric that is used to describe the people of the Balkans, consider this recent observation from a British humanitarian, which is a term that certainly has loaded meaning across this peninsula. So this is, again, recent, and it may be kind of shocking. The Serbs are a two-dimensional people with a craving for simplicity and ideology so basic it can be understood without effort. They need enemies, not friends, to focus their two-dimensional ideas on. Life for them is a simple tune, never an orchestration, or even a pleasant harmony. Animals make better use of their resources with much greater philosophy than these retorted creatures, whose subscription to the human race is well in arrears.
Oh my God.
So, in reality, the people of the Balkan Peninsula are neither incorrigibly backwards patriarchal barbarians, nor are they victims in need of Western salvation. And it's important for revolutionaries around the world, including here in the United States, to understand how this peninsula became the Balkans, a term that has become synonymous with the geographical location, but also with the pejorative, the state of mind which it implies, which is, as Misha Glenny, who wrote the center book there, notes, is a predilection for deceit, exaggeration, and unreliability. How did it come to be that academics could write book after book asking if the region was doomed to instability by the geography, by the inherent backwards cultures of the people who live there, and most insultingly, if the fate of the Balkans has been the fault of the inferior genetics of the humans who live there and have built their homes there? Revolutionaries in the United States must understand that, far from being the center of some sort of imaginative whirlpool where every known superstition of the world is gathered, my roommate and I joke about this all the time, there are material forces at play in the Balkans. Regular people, peasants, and workers, just like you and I, who have stood up again and again to the Ottoman Empire's occupation, to the Austrians, the Germans, and the Italians who invaded the Balkans for its geostrategic position, to the dictatorships, Stalinist and otherwise, which followed the Second World War and persisted into the 1990s, against ethnic sectarianism and foreign intervention, against austerity, privatization, and false independence, UN administration, in other words. And it is these forces, the struggle between classes and between imperial rivals, which themselves are rooted in the economy and the struggle over the place of the Balkans in the world, which explain the situation today. These dynamics are important for US revolutionaries to understand, not just because, as Trotsky pointed out in one of his first articles on the Balkan question, that, quote, every thinking worker should follow attentively the course of the revolutionary struggle throughout the world, which requires that revolutionaries everywhere to become familiar with the situation in different countries, but because the forces of Western imperialism have played a large role in shaping the situation in the Balkans today, and because our futures as workers and as colonized people are bound up together, regardless of how foreign and exotic we are made to appear to one another. So in this talk, we're going to do an extremely whirlwind tour of history, and I mean that because we're covering from the 14th century to the present. This is meant to be an introduction to a topic with which few people in the United States are familiar, and I realize and I apologize if I'm sort of making things too basic for people in the room, but I want to make sure we don't leave anyone behind. So we're going to start with what are the Balkans, who lives there, how did a piece of land quite literally attached to Europe become not quite European, how did Big C communism, Stalinism, shape the political terrain over the last half of the 20th century, why did the US intervene in the breakup of Yugoslavia, what has been the effect of more than a decade of shock doctrine to the economies, and most importantly, what can Marxists learn from studying this region, how can we stand in solidarity with the people struggling across the region, in struggles that are so similar to ours here in the US, and what do we say about the future of the Balkans? So if nothing else today, I want to convince you that the Balkan people are both a product of a dynamic historical process, and they are the shapers of that process. As Marx said, we make history, but not in the circumstances of our own choosing. So first, just a little bit of housekeeping. So what are we talking about when we talk about the Balkans? Now, there's a lot of disagreement over exactly what constitutes. Most people here will probably immediately think of Yugoslavia, the countries that formerly made up the Yugoslavia. And that includes, in no particular order, Montenegro, Bosnia, Serbia, Croatia, Slovenia, Kosovo, and Macedonia. However, Greece and Albania are also part of the peninsula, quite obviously. Bulgaria and Romania are also considered part of the Balkans through the construction of their own histories. And then there's always the question of Moldova, which is sort of there, but generally is more ascribed to the Eastern Bloc, even though it has a stranger position. And also because a lot of people try to move particularly Bulgaria and Romania up into Central Europe. So another thing is that the question of the term, the Balkans, I think is something I want to address, that this has long been a pejorative. It was an outside imposition laid on by a very poor geography. Someone thought the Balkan Mountains went all the way across the peninsula. Nobody bothered to check. So it's now, but it quickly became a political term, which was a dangerous term laden with the potential for the destruction, for destruction and destabilization. And late in the 20th century, it's now become fashionable to say Southeastern Europe. And I reject this term because Balkan is a term that's laden with the history of the region. And it's actually necessary to contend with that history. It cannot be erased. Balkan is the term that has been used to exclude people from Europe, but I think it's also the basis for left political unity on the peninsula. And the Balkans are affixed, like I've said several times now, to the continent of Europe geographically, but they are not European politically or historically. And for this reason, I don't think we will go forward referring to them that way. Okay, so now into the whirlwind tour of talking about the entire Ottoman Empire in 5 minutes. So obviously there were nation states on the Balkan Peninsula before the Ottoman Empire, but this is really the beginning of modern history in the region. And what's really important to understand, there are so many cool stories you could tell about the resistance to the Ottoman occupation, the feuds that were fought over who would administer the Ottoman state, etc. But I think what's really important to understand is why a working class does not develop in the Balkan region in this period, and why in the Ottoman Empire generally there's not a very strong development of a working class, given that the breakup of the Ottoman Empire is really not complete till the First World War. And so this is because there was actually a political decision made by the sultans to not industrialize the country for fear of the proletariat actually gaining power and posing a threat to Ottoman political reign. And because it was such a long-standing empire, there was actually the capacity to sort of exert political control that way. They also alternated between high centralization and decentralization of the empire. And so this meant that the power of the sultan was exerted through regional structures of power, which were quite specific to the places they occurred in. So some places, you see the development in like places like Romania of a nobility, where in Greece, you actually see more of the development of a civil service. All of that is, again, an extremely truncated 500-year history. So the underdevelopment of the Balkans during the rule of the Ottoman Empire put the newly independent Balkan states, which begins in about, I mean, there's attempts at independence early in the 19th century, but real independence starts to begin around the 1870s. The newly independent Balkan states into a very difficult and contradictory position. Economic development required the unification of the peninsula, because again, it's not actually that big of a place. And yet Ottoman rule had driven it apart. And Trotsky really illuminates this process in his correspondence for Pravda. And this is, he says, quote, "First and foremost stands the national question. The motley composition of the population of Turkey," and here he's talking, when he says Turkey, he's talking about the Ottoman Empire, "as regards nationality and religion, results in powerful centrifugal tendencies. The old regime thought it could be overcome by the mechanical weight of the army, recruited extensively from the Muslims," and just as an aside, recruiting Christians would have been very difficult because Christians were not allowed to ride horses or own weapons, which are sort of the standards for being in the military at this time of history. In fact, this process brought about the disintegration of the state. In other words, when the Ottomans failed to secure political hegemony in a rapidly transforming world, because again, while here you still have an overwhelmingly peasant population, the rest of Europe and the world economy is transitioning into a global industrial capitalism. So the world of the end of the Ottoman Empire, you see it portrayed in films, it's still very much portrayed as, like if you were to place that in another area of Europe, you would place it as probably the 1400s or 1500s, but that's actually the social reality of the Ottoman Empire at the end of the 19th century. At the same time, you know, Victorian London is being built on the backs of colonization and the newly formed proletariat. So when the Ottomans failed to secure political hegemony in this rapidly transforming world, they then turned to military force, and this inevitably backfired. The great powers began to interfere. Military force backfired again because it caused uprisings among the people, and they're too numerous to actually go into all of them right now. The great powers began to interfere, and that's particularly the Austrians and the British, and most notably the Germans. This led Trotsky to observe that, quote, no end could be foreseen to the dismemberment of Turkey, the Ottoman Empire. Yet an extensive and economically unified territory is a necessary precondition for industrial development. This applies not only to Turkey, but to the Balkan Peninsula as a whole. It is not the existence of national diversity, but the splintering into many states that weighs on the latter like a curse. Customs borders divide it artificially into separate bits. The machinations of the capitalist powers are interwoven with the bloody intrigues of the Balkan dynasties. If these conditions continue, the peninsula will go on being a Pandora's box. Only a single state of all Balkan nationalities with a democratic basis can bring internal peace to the Balkans and create the conditions for a mighty development of productive forces. And again, this is an argument that will sound very familiar to people who are familiar with the one state argument for Palestine. But also involved in the breakup of the Ottoman Empire were not just the external contradictions, but the internal social and labor contradictions of development. And that's primarily the development of radical agrarian programs by sections of the peasantry, primarily in Armenia and Bosnia. These were developed by sections of the peasantry who comprised the majority of the population and who were subjected to semi-serfdom at the whim of the Sultan's men in the territory. And this resulted in discontent in the army, which was primarily drawn from the peasant class and seriously undercut the ability of the empire to impose its will on the peasantry, who were then being expected to police themselves. Moving into World War I, I'm not actually going to have time to talk about it that much, but I think it's a very good illustration of the sort of historical trajectory of the argument that the Balkans just draw everyone else into their conflicts and it's all their fault, right? Because obviously people were probably told in school that it was, you know, poor little Serb who shot the person and the Austro-Hungarian diplomat. And if it just hadn't been for them, nothing about World War I would ever have happened. Clearly, right? Moving into World War II is actually a better example of what I think is a process that happens in both of these periods. So wars are largely, the world wars, the European wars, have largely been a mechanism for restructuring the region politically and economically. In World War II, the Italians and the Germans moved quickly to occupy the Balkans, which were a key strategic point for their location as the nexus of Asia and Europe, and as a gateway to several seas in the Mediterranean, and particularly for Germany for launching an invasion of the USSR. The Balkans fell very quickly, overwhelmed by the firepower of the Germans in particular, who within a few hours destroyed Belgrade and killed more than 17,000 people. Once occupied, the Nazis simply had to defend their strategic position, and that would allow them to launch the invasion of the Soviet Union. The Bulgarians operated in cooperation with the Germans. They imposed confiscatory measures, and this resulted in hoarding and massive supply problems within a month. And this caused a massive crisis of supply, particularly in Greece. Yugoslavia was chopped into 9 units. Slovenia was split in 2. The south was annexed by Italy, the north by Germany. Italy took the Dalmatian section of Croatia. Independent Croatia included all of Bosnia and Herzegovina, Slavonia, but it was also blocked by Italian and German military zones that completely destroyed the ability of people to travel and to make a living from their land. And again, these military zones were built on the towns and the corpses of the peasantry. Montenegro, which was, I actually forgot to mention this, but Montenegro is the one area in the Balkans that was never conquered by the Ottomans because it's very mountainous and they were able to sort of keep out the Ottomans. But Montenegro lost much of its territory to Albania and then became an independent protectorate of Italy. Kosovo and Macedonia were split into pieces. Vojvodina, which is part of Serbia, was annexed to Hungary, and Bulgaria took sections of Serbia and Macedonia. The Germans established a puppet government in Serbia, which then drew support from the thugs of the Serbian fascist movement. Oh my God, I thought I was so good at timing this. Germany didn't expect resistance and consequently moved most of its troops out of the region, but clearly they got resistance. The history of the partisans is something I'm not gonna have time to go into, but it's really one of the great struggles against occupation and dictatorship. So the struggle of the partisans and the communists against the fascist occupation began in September 1941, within just a couple of weeks after the occupation of Belgrade. Tito organized the partisans, and who aimed to liberate broad swaths of territory and place them under the political control of the KPJ, which is the Yugoslav Communist Party. Other resistance was waged by the less organized Chetniks, who were the legacy of the irregular forces in the Ottoman Empire and were ethnically Serb. The KPJ rightly rejected the leadership of the Chetniks politically and demanded that the Communist Party retain political leadership. The Chetniks were also weakened by their inability to understand the historical process that was taking place. They believed the goal of the German occupation was the genocide of the Serbs, and I think history should forgive them for thinking this, because it was certainly understandable why they might have thought that. However, the Chetniks, because they were linked to the Serb villages, did not actually see that this was a political struggle that was about more than ethnicity, and even though the Communist Party maintained political hegemony, they collaborated on military campaigns with the Chetniks until the end of the war, when a massive purge campaign with the newly formed secret police actually ended up killing a lot of the same people who had been fighting alongside them. And it was, you know, you get these really horrendous stories of people who had survived the Gestapo only to be killed by the secret police of the Communist Party. So meanwhile, camps established around the Balkans resulted in the extermination of nearly 1.5 million Balkan Jews, and the Germans used the national aspirations of some segments of Balkan society to justify the existence of the camps, particularly in Croatia. Many Jews were not even taken to camps, however, and were rather slaughtered in the streets within days or even hours of the Germans' arrival. The program of terrorizing the Jewish population unleashed waves of terror against others, Roma, gay and lesbians, political dissidents, and even Western citizens. Some Jews sought refuge in the Italian-controlled areas, particularly of Albania, others in the partisan-controlled regions of the country. So the wars resulted in the victory of communism across the Balkan Peninsula, but of course it was a Stalinist leadership that came through, and it came through on a wave of blood. But I think what's also important to know is that there were segments, particularly of the working class in Romania, that actually saw the capacity to build a genuine coalition with the peasantry and actually have a revolution from below. But that was completely forestalled by the end of the war, which forced countries to choose between the Americans and the USSR for much needed aid in the absence of reparations. Terror continued as the communists took power. Again, when I'm saying communists, I'm talking big C, Stalinist communists, but we're gonna get to a little bit why using Stalinist is not exactly the right word for everything across the peninsula. Some Nazi collaborators, many civilians, including women, and some of the people who were killed were Nazi collaborators, but many were civilians, including women and children. And like I said, some of the Chetnik leaders, like Dmitry Dojtypych, survived the raids of the Gestapo only to be killed by the newly established secret police. The mass arrests were so many that young men from the labor market, it withdrew so many young men from the labor market that the economy nearly collapsed and all but destroyed the penal system, which couldn't cope with the volume. And in Greece, again, which I feel so bad now that he's not here that I didn't talk at all about it. Greece is really important, so you just go to everything about Greece this weekend. In Greece, the partisan struggle soon led to a civil war. But I think a really important thing is to see how the struggle of the partisans actually carries over into the beginning of the communist period. And this is that the links made by the partisans with the pressures placed on the government for agrarian collectivization and a drought that leads to a rebellion. only a couple of years after the end of the war. Peasants, by the thousands, take up arms to be able to control the produce of their cities. And it, you know, the most well-remembered one is in Chasin, but it actually took, there were dozens of them all across Yugoslavia at the same time. The rebellions forced a retreat from collectivization, and it drove some members of the KPJ to rethink the extractive relationship of the cities to the countryside. And again, sort of undercut the idea that the Communist Party was completely monolithic. There was always dissent, always people who thought that there were other ways to organize society beyond capitalism and beyond the Stalinist leadership. So meanwhile, on the east-west side of the peninsula, the west side of the peninsula, you have Albania, which is its own special case. And again, I'm not going to have a ton of time to go into, but I want to give a little bit of an overview. First is that, and this is again the split I'm talking about, is that Yugoslavia is expelled from the Common Form, which is the Eastern European collection of the Common Term, basically. And this, what this had the effect of doing, as Hoxha allied with Stalin against Yugoslavia, again, not saying Yugoslavia was not great, but they had said, we're not aligned with Stalin anymore. We're actually going to be as like a non-allied, and then we're with the non-allied movement. But what this did was it rendered the ethnic Albanians inside Yugoslavia as inherently suspect for their alleged commitment to the idea of a unified Albania and to the Hoxha government. And what this does is it actually sows the seeds of the 1990s through reparation campaign, or repatriation campaigns. And what these were attempts to say that the Albanians are actually not native to the peninsula, that they're actually outsiders, and they have to be forcibly removed and sent to Turkey. But then meanwhile, with inside Albania, it's a massively repressive society. You know, you're not allowed to leave the country. The border guards have shoot-to-kill orders, and people who are fleeing from Yugoslavia to try and get to Russia, you know, some people end up trapped there and things like this. However, all of these forces then come together, and so Albania was forced on, you know, it was both a society of closed borders, and it had massive, massive xenophobia as well to help maintain that politically. But outside of Albania, the democratic demands of Albanians within Yugoslavia then has the effect of a massive cultural revival, which is centered on the University of Pristina. And again, just to give a little bit of educational background, Albanian language education was very late in developing. It was actually illegal to write in Albanian until the 1870s. And again, there were massive efforts to forestall Albanian education going forward, which gives another view of exactly what this backwardness is, right? So at the university, it's again a mostly Albanian movement, but demanding democratic rights within Yugoslavia. There's not actually, at the beginning, a demand for separation from Yugoslavia. And it sort of sets the lines up for, again, what happens later, that this is going to be the flashpoint because this is the center of political organizing. And soon after the death of Tito in 1980, you see a massive upheaval within inside Yugoslavia, all across. There are student protests, massive strikes, particularly in extractive industries. And again, just sort of foreshadowing what's about to come, the rise of Serb nationalism takes place in the context of increasing foreign debt, the calls for independence from Kosovo students, the rigidity of the government after the death of Tito and its inability to change in any sensible way, reversive reforms that had allowed women more access to education and that had helped to begin to break down the patriarchal structures which had so long governed society in the Balkans. And finally, in 1986, is the Sanu Memorandum, which claimed that Serbs are under genocidal threat, particularly in Croatia. And for all of the reasons of demographics and politics, Croatia, Bosnia, and Kosovo were the targets of this Serb nationalism, even though Serbs were minorities in other areas throughout the Balkans. Belgrade tightened its grips on the provinces, revoked autonomy, which had been a central aspect of the Tito government, and began to exert a Serb nationalist project, which had been held in place and even entirely absent in some places. By 1991, The war between the Serbs and the Croats is all but inevitable. And it has a domino effect first because of the voting structure of Yugoslavia and the imbalance that it renders when one nation left the federation. But I also want to go back to the broader geopolitical situation, which is the breakup of the Soviet Union and the loss of stability that existed in the Cold War, albeit a terrifying one, based on a vision of mutually assured destruction and a mutual commitment by the US and the USSR to global imperial extraction. And now I just want to revisit, I don't have time to talk about all of the conflicts in the 1990s. I just want to go back, I think, to sort of break down some of the myths around the battle in Kosovo and why it's become such a powerful question. Because the standard narrative we get is 1388, Field of the Bathbirds, Kosovo Polje. And this is a created myth that's used to justify any number of policies and claims. And it actually belies the fact that since the Ottoman Empire, people were actually more likely to define themselves religiously than they were necessarily by their national origin. So the idea of like these very strong nationalist tendencies is actually a fairly new thing. And the idea that they existed since 1388 is just ridiculous and bizarre. And so I think that the left platform inside Vendosia, which is the sort of Kosovar version of Syriza, actually provides a really clear insight into why Kosovo becomes such a polarizing idea within Serbia and why it has become so essential to ruling class power there. So in their polemic, Why Self-Determination, which is that Vendosia translates as self-determination, they write, self-determination because freedom is the solution and freedom will only be granted when it is not left up to the conscience of Belgrade, because the problem of Kosovo will never be solved while its aim is to change the Serbian opinion on the question of Kosovo instead of ensuring that the freedom of the people is never left to someone's opinion. Self-determination is a strong strike against hegemonic aspirations and that also recognizes the need for collective freedom, and it will encourage the end of fascism in Serbia. The members of Vendosia in Kosovo say that self-determination is an essential precondition for the growth of a radical left inside of Serbia, and thus the collective liberation of the peninsula is bound up with the project of national self-determination for Kosovo. But all of this doesn't take place in a vacuum, and so I think now I just want to sort of shift to talk quickly about how long has that been there?
A few minutes.
Okay. You're fine. So the imposition of austerity, the complicity of the national ruling classes in the name of joining Europe, which is not something that most people are want to do. In this process, it feeds into all kinds of racist ideas and aspirations that encourages the growth of fascism. The EU needs cheap Balkan labor in its factories and its fields, but has no interest in political rights for migrants. The Balkans would be better to align themselves instead with the migrants drowning each day in the Mediterranean, especially when we think how many Balkan migrants lost their lives drowning in the Adriatic as they tried to flee in tiny motorboats to Italy. And really what's happened is that UNMIK, UN mission in Kosovo, and outside rule in Bosnia have tried to create client states in the Balkans in the rubble of the 1990s, treading over people's political sovereignty to do so. The legacies of Stalinism rendered the left weak in much of the Balkan Peninsula, and yet, in response to the material conditions of economic crisis and climate change, which have really affected the western portion of the peninsula with flooding, a new left has begun to take shape. The broad outlines of this left make me very hopeful, but they also present very serious challenges. A combination of the desire to distance themselves from the legacy of the Stalinist regimes and the communist regimes, combined with the politics that were conceptualized not as class politics, but rather as people fighting an entrenched and corrupt state bureaucracy, have given a hearing to the calls for anti-politics and for broad populism. So let me deal really quickly with each of these things. Anti-politics is broadly related to what here in the US we talk about as being a narco-liberalism, and it's characterized by an incredibly contradictory set of ideas. First, that the people, broadly speaking, so like the 99% in this language, have the power to liberate themselves through mass, spontaneous, collective action, much like what we saw in Tuzla. And at the same time, that the same people who are simultaneously capable of liberating themselves are incapable of organizing themselves into a democratic organization that exists for the purpose of political leadership and action. And even beyond this strain of politics, a new left in the Balkans has a very strong anarchist current, which I think is really laid out extremely well in Don't Mourn, Balkanize, and which, while understandable in the shadow of Stalinism, provides no way forward. I'm convinced that the way to win an argument for organization, however, is to prove its necessity in practice. And this was certainly the case in Tuzla, where last year, as I mentioned before, a workers' council called the Plenum took over the leadership of the city. This was an uprising that was in response to an incredibly oppressive state, which has created essentially an apartheid state that institutionalized formerly mythologized ancient ethnic hatred and made them into a reality. There are segregated schools which serve only to reproduce xenophobia and chauvinism, and a political establishment that profits from the reactionary squabbling which these ethnic fiefdoms, these modern-day colonies engender. The contemporary Bosnian state cannot even extend basic democratic rights to all of its citizens, and as this blogger says, only those belonging to so-called constitutive nations, which is again harking back to the idea of Yugoslavia, that the constitutive nations were the Serbs, the Bosnians, the Slovenians, etc. And even then, only those living in appropriately homogenous locales can really secure some semblance of supposed representation. Now, an uprising that attempts to take power requires organization, yet the viability of the Plenum was undermined by its still ability to establish basic structures. In a city of about 130,000, only a few hundred participated in the decision-making process, not on the basis of being elected outside of a few of the workers' committees in the factories, but rather organized as sort of a movement of the squares, which, again, many of us have been through the experience of Occupy here. Imagine trying to run a city as an Occupy council. How fun that would be. This has also been clear in Kosovo, where the emergence of Lvizja Vendosja, the movement for self-determination, has grown as an organization and begun to take seats in parliamentary elections, even as it continues to grow in the streets and the workplaces. But Vendosja, as exciting as it is, and while it is broadly a left party, still treads on the side of populism. And populism, as people familiar with the history of this country will know, has incredible potential in moments where the broad sentiment is to the left, but it can also be overtaken by the right. And this is why you actually need socialist politics inside of these movements to actually argue that, no, we actually need a party with clear politics, not just to do whatever the masses decide will be done. Over the years since its founding in 2005, Vet Vendosja has tracked very consistently to the left, and as I said before, it could be seen as a Kosovar idea of Syriza. This is a very positive development, especially as you have workers beginning to confront ethnic sectarianism in their workplaces. And so a really good example of this is earlier this year, there was a miner strike in the city of Trepshka, and it began that the Albanian workers walked off, and in the process they threw some stones at somebody. It's not entirely clear what happened, but an ethnically Serb minister then called them savages and demanded that they go back to work. And instead of being torn off against them, the Serb workers walked off with the Albanians, which is an incredibly important and positive development. So this is an example. Another example Students have returned to the streets from the university, and people across the country have begun to rebel against the colonial sell-off of their resources. Again, remembering that UNMIK actually controls the decision, even though there is a parliament, UNMIK makes the final decisions over what will happen. UNMIK has attempted to carry out privatization of services in Pristina and around the country in defiance of a law which should have prevented it. This belies how false the so-called independence of Kosovo is, how it remains a colony of the UN and the EU, supplying to Germany and Austria a cheap supply of undocumented labor, tearing apart the weak social fabric of the countryside where there are often no schools, and encouraging the persistence of patriarchal family structures which disappeared in the years of the Yugoslav constitution when social services were widely available, as was education, including education for women. So the last question I want to take up is probably the most important, and that's why I wanted to end on it. And that's the question of the nation. Because I think the situation in the Balkans really allows us to dig into the heart of the question of national liberation and socialism in a very contemporary context, and I realize I'm out of time, so I'm gonna go really fast. Sorry if I lose you. So in Don't Mourn Balkanize, there's a call for the reformation of the Balkan Federation, like not the the reformation, like to make again the Balkan Federations. But in doing so, grants no legitimacy to the national aspirations of the people of the oppressed nations, particularly the people of Kosovo and Bosnia, because there can be no unity without the full allowance of self-determination, which in the current context is the creation of an independent state, and likely, in the case of Kosovo, unification with Albania, not because that's the best thing to have happen, but because that's what the people generally want. This represents the limitations of national dependence in a capitalist world. National liberation, there can be no Balkan unity that is not first founded on the right to self-determination. The early Soviet Union understood this when they allowed the member nations the right to secede. And in fact, the period of worldwide upheaval in the early 20th century, the peak of which was the Russian Revolution, the question of how to achieve international working class unity was one of the primary questions. Revolutionaries like Luxembourg and Bukharin argued that all national aspirations must be opposed. And in this tradition, Grupovic fails, in other words, or he falls in this tradition. In other words, that they oppose political independence because they realize that economic independence is impossible in the context of capitalist world competition. But Lenin, rather, noted that, quote, if in our political agitation we fail to advance and advocate the slogan of the right to secession, we shall play into the hands not only of the bourgeoisie, but also of the feudal landlords and the absolutism of the oppressor nation. And here I want to quote the esteemed Paul D'Amato at length, because I think in The Meaning of Marxism, he actually lays this out really clearly, and I don't really feel the need to reinvent the wheel. So Lenin understood that real international working class unity could not be built merely by proclaiming it. Because the oppression of small or weaker nations by larger or stronger ones is a reality, the division of workers by nation, their mutual national mistrust, and the nationalism and chauvinism that binds them to their own ruling class's interests cannot be overcome merely by calling for international solidarity. In order for there not to be the slightest mistrust between the workers of the oppressed and the oppressor nations, Lenin argued socialists must stand for the complete equality of nations against any national privileges of one nation over the other. One cannot support the full equality of nations unless vigorously one supports the right of the oppressed nations to self-determination, that is, their right to secede from the imperial power that oppresses them. Naturally, within the limits of capitalism, this is an impractical demand, and clearly cannot be completely fulfilled so long as capitalist relations continue. And this is the point that advancing the democratic slogan is an important means by which socialists strengthen and advance the unity of the international working class, upon which struggle against capitalism depended. So just to conclude here now, and I promise I am concluding, the vision of a pan-Balkan unity is something I share with Grupovic. And not because it will turn the peninsula into utopia, which he implies with his concept of prefigurative socialism as the daily practice of unity, but because the political independence of the Balkans is the necessary precondition for the struggle of revolutionary socialism, and because the liberation of the workers of Europe is bound up with the liberation of the Balkans, and because it is a challenge to the imperial relations of power which mask the inequalities of globalization, making it appear that the world we live in is somehow massively unidentifiable to the colonialism of 70 years ago. So while there have clearly been changes, I think there's also a lot of similarities to draw on. So the Balkan question is a regional one, but it is also an important thing to the broader global political economy. The question, rather, is how do we get there to pan-Balkan unity? We cannot shed the national aspiration any more than we can shed the social relations to capitalism without going through the revolutionary process. And this must be by making history in conditions not of our own choosing, which in our case means in the shadow of the state and in the shadow of colonial domination. The muck of ages, ethnic sectarianism, and strong commitment to the nation must be shed in the process of struggle and through the attainment of meaningful freedom in which we can actually make a socialist world.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.